Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith. He's author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, and Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy, Pathfinding, Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic, also Will You Be Richer or Poorer, and recently a book, Global Crisis, National Renewal, A Revolutionary Grand Strategy for the United States. His blog of twominds.com is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. Well, I'm thrilled that we're going to talk about my latest book, which just was published this past week. The title is Self-Reliance in the 21st Century. And the reason why I titled it In the 21st Century is the most famous essay about self-reliance, at least in North America, is titled Self-Reliance by Ralph Waldo Emerson, who wrote it in 1841. And in that era, Emerson was describing self-reliance as independence of thought and action. And he used terminology that's quite modern, which was striking in that more traditionalist time. He said that we should all be our best selves, because that's what we alone can do, is to be our best selves and to not follow others' footsteps, to make our own decisions. And so this independence of thought and action is kind of the essential foundation of self-reliance as Emerson was describing it. But interesting thing was, back then the economy was much more localized than it is today. In other words, most people got their food, energy, water, and had their work right there in their locale. Even if you lived in a city, your food source was within walking distance, right? or a short distance away, and you were creating a lot of the household necessities yourself or trading for them with your own labor. So that localized sort of much more self-sufficient economy is in really stark contrast to the economy we have today, which I would describe as hyper-globalized and hyper-financialized, meaning that in many cases, the things that we rely on, essential elements in our lives, such as food, such as tools, our work, that these come from thousands of miles away. And we can also say the same thing about financialization, that a lot of people are living off the wealth of what you and I know is basically just leverage and credit. It's not the creation of goods and services and jobs that's creating the wealth now. It's speculation based on leverage and credit and gaming the system, insider trading, you know, stock buybacks, you know, all that stuff. And so people are relying on that bubble wealth and thinking that they're going to be just fine. But there's a difference between having some money and being self-reliant. You know, that money is not necessarily self-reliance. And self-reliance is not exactly self-sufficiency. You know, like Emerson's friend, Thoreau, you know, famously lived on a little cabin that he built himself on Walden Pond, on land owned by Emerson, by the way. And he wrote about being relatively self-sufficient, and by today's standards, radically self-sufficient. But he was not that. What his skill set was not uncommon in 1841. I mean, he grew some beans, he foraged, he built his own, you know, cabin. All those skills were common in 1841. Now we have very few people have those basic skills of self-reliance. So I you know, you and I have each are on our own paths to increase our self-reliance. And so before we started recording, you made a really good point about the educational system, the vast difference between then and now.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because the whole educational system has tended toward a trend of less thinking outside the box, which is what it should be focused on, right? Is teaching people how to think outside the box, thinking how to solve a problem, thinking how to make diminishing resources go farther. That's what it's all about. But instead, it's tended to emphasize traits of less thinking outside the box, more consensus building, less conflict, and less challenge, in terms of like challenging discussions. Debate, right, used to be an essential facet of the educational system, especially like in the UK, the British educational system. But nowadays, it's either not addressed, not being really a trend to emphasize on that. And so you end up this sort of consensus building culture where there's not much skill set outside of some generic skills. And that's not a good thing. If we compare what happened now back to the Great Depression, the US Great Depression, at least then there was some link back to the land, so there was some knowledge of farming, of some self-reliance on that basis, but living off the land and farming. But nowadays there's very little connection to that. Larger percentage of the people have been living in cities. Some even have no knowledge of farming or gardening, unaware of whether vegetable grows above ground or below ground. And so, yeah, it's not a good situation. So, your book is very timely and very valuable at this time.
Yeah, Richard, again, before we started recording, you we were talking about the timeliness, and it hadn't really occurred to me. I tend to think that we're entering a decade where globalization, and especially hyper-globalization, is eroding, and it seems to be eroding quickly. And I think financialization is also unraveling. And so the two things that people depend on are basically melting into the sands. And so they're going to be in real trouble, because they don't have any substitution for what they're getting from globalization and financialization. And so what we're talking about is, if you make progress on your self-reliance now, while you still have the income and capital, it's going to be better than money in the bank.
Yes. No, that's a very important point we're discussing before the start of our podcast today. The idea that, there still is some measure of currency purchasing power. Some people have savings, or you might have a 401k plan, or in the US, or RSP plan, this similar type of setup in Canada or elsewhere. And even though the markets are going down, there's still some purchasing power left to convert into sustainability, self-reliance, because I think if you wait too long, it could be a point in time where a lot of that asset, that phantom wealth, has disappeared, and you no longer have as much or any means to convert that into systems here that we're talking about, like, are relating to food, water, energy, transportation. And we can go, specifically into each one, what, some ideas that we see happening that people are doing to increase self-reliance. But yeah, This is the time it's advised to do action now, essentially before it's too late.
Right. And we can go through the sort of essentials of life. But I'm going to preface that by mentioning that, for a lot of people, they're going to find that the place they live in now is just not conducive to self-reliance. And in other words, there's no water, or it comes in a canal or a pipe from 1,000 miles away. Or maybe there's no energy within thousands of miles, transportable energy. Everything's generated elsewhere. And there's no food production in their locale. And just as important, maybe they're in a place where the local government has so many restrictions and codes and that the number of permissions you need to become more self-reliant is prohibitive. And so, you might have to move to a place where the number of permissions you need to do something for yourself is lower, and that the local culture actually, supports self-reliance and localized production. So that's another reason why your capital might have to put to use to actually buy a place where self-reliance is just a lot easier. Because if you're going to pick a place where everything is just ridiculously expensive and difficult, it just makes your path to self-reliance that much harder.
And it doesn't necessarily mean you should move out west, or where there's more wide open spaces. That's not necessarily the answer, because a lot of these places out west are either desert areas, dry. There's challenges with the water supply, level of rainfall. There's certainly a lot of places back east, in the eastern U.S., eastern Canada, locations where there's sufficient good amount of rainfall, lots of trees, so there's lots of resources there, right? You got timber resources, water resources, just a climate that's more conducive, right, to growing food, and it's still very quiet spaces, like up in the hills, and these could be not too far from major metropolitan areas as well.
No, you're absolutely right. Small cities, small towns, suburbs. As I said, it depends kind of on the culture as well. If it's like the local city or the county encourages, home gardens and farmers markets, and there's local nonprofits that have like 3D fabrication facilities, so where people can come in and make parts for themselves. These kinds of things are just an enormous benefit, and it's part of the infrastructure that you want to join that's already there, as opposed to going to some place where nobody grows any food, there's no gardens, or the gardens are banned, and nobody's in the maker production kind of mindset. And of course, what we're trying to do is become productive, not just be consumers.
Yeah, exactly. This is the whole trend now that was catapulted, especially during the COVID era, the whole migration from cities to suburbs, from and also to exurbs, to farming areas, or from the maybe migrating from the suburb to a farming area. This is happening globally, and especially like in the U.S., Canada, lots of people moving out of cities to buy a few acres of land. Essentially, doesn't have to be too far away from the city, but that's certainly the trend, as you mentioned, we know a lot of people that are doing that as well. Both of us, we're hearing stories. It's quite evident also in the real estate market.
Right, right. Well, we've talked a lot about energy and the transition to a more sustainable economy. And so you had some thoughts about energy self-reliance. And we're, again, we're not talking about complete off-grid, although, you know, in certain cases that may be the way to go. But for most of us, it's just providing some of what we need, as opposed to being 100% dependent on sources, you know, thousands of miles away.
Yeah, and just before we get into those examples, just to mention at the outset, as we were discussing initially, is this is very timely now, your book, especially given what's going on in the economy and the political environment. I mean, we've been through the COVID challenges, and then there's this whole World Economic Forum Great Reset that has been launched during this time period, and it's a lot of it is about governments using that opportunity to get more control on the people, given all the challenges with unsustainable debt and unsustainable unfunded liabilities, like on the pensions, is what's really driving it at the highest level. And so it all comes down to an answer or a theme of trying to become as independent as possible is the best solution to, you know, to preserving your freedoms, your liberties, and your way of life. Otherwise, you know, you'll become dependent and you'll become subject to control at the whims of politicians. So we like to say, you know, try to look towards the Amish and the Mennonites as a model, actually. Of I know, you know, many of us can't go to that level of self-reliance, but I think that's a good model to look at. Your thoughts on that, Charles?
Yeah, that's a great example, Richard, because when you think of those lifestyles, you don't have to have the exact same religious faith of those groups, because what they do is they use very little. In other words, they consume very little from the global economy, right? They make or produce much of what they consume, and they rely very little on globalized supply chains. And then they also rely on the community. In other words, they help each other. And so that cooperation, I think it's really important that we remember that that is the key, as in terms of natural selection, the key advantage of the human species is our ability to cooperate, you know, to share information and share resources and help each other. And so I think, in my view, self-reliance in the 21st century it requires going back to the community model, where you don't have to produce everything yourself, because someone in your community is making more of one thing that you could use, and you're making more of something else, and then you can just trade. And this is of course that's basic, you know, small scale capitalism going back to, you know, the Bronze Age, right? Yeah. You create a surplus and you find a way to generate a trade that you get something that you value and in exchange for what you're producing. And so the key is that we're producing something, and it could be a good, you know, a product, or it can be a service that we can then trade in our local community, you know, and then that creates this communication, and we're helping each other, and we're lowering our reliance on global supply chains. And I'll give an example from my life. I mean, bicycles are not useful in the dead of winter, of course, in many places, but it just as an example of a very simple technology. Well, during the whole COVID supply chain disruption, I was talking to guys and they couldn't get parts for their bicycles, you know. In other words, all these things are sourced from Taiwan or, you know, thousands of miles away in Asia. And so it's like, well, wait a minute, even a simple machine is now dependent on the global supply chain that is very easily broken. That's not smart. That's not a smart way to live. Yeah. So if you have a bicycle, number one, get a few spare parts for things, you know, and also start making friends with other bicyclists who then have derailleurs that they could, you know, swap out to your bike. And, you know, that kind of mentality is, you know, is the idea is is the more we can do for ourselves and the less we consume, the less dependent we're going to be on these supply chains that really make no sense in a lot of ways. And that's why they're unraveling.
Yeah, absolutely. The our firm Cedar Gold, we have a an index of great businesses from around the world that we maintain manage, and these businesses and our whole approach is based on what's called market environmentalism. It's a set of four principles that have been distilled from the Austrian Economic Center in Vienna, Austria, and the American Conservation Coalition in the US. And we have the four principles on our website. You can actually become a signatory to those four principles. But it's essentially, it emphasizes local solutions, everything you're talking about, localized solutions, decentralized solutions, emphasis on property rights, like if those that have the ownership of the land are more likely to take better care of the land, right, instead of some unowned or government piece of land where people care less, right, than if it were their own. Also emphasis on innovation and technology solutions. So it's all about the natural market, and less about agenda-based environmentalism. And so that's a big difference. And we think it makes sense, it works, as the examples you give, not only in your most recent book, but in all of your books, you emphasize these principles and examples. So that's really good to follow.
You're right. And if we were to describe a localized productive economy, then of course those principles are exactly what we what we would pick, right? That's what we'd say. This is optimizing a localized, very productive economy, because, you know, we're not in shifting from being a totally dependent consumer to being a more self-reliant producer of essentials and valuable goods and services, that we're not going to be creating value, in the abstract. We're going to be creating it within our own communities, right? And so, and I think the other good point that we've talked about before is that there's a lot of opportunity here. You know, it's like the bad model of capitalism is there's a, you know, one factory or one distribution center in town, and then that's it. You know, you're totally dependent on one or two industries or one or two companies for most of the jobs. Well, that's a very fragile system. So the kind of localized innovation economy is like, has a lot of opportunity for people. Like, what are you interested in? Well, then, you know, one of Emerson's sayings is, you know, do the thing and you shall have the power. In other words, just start doing it, you know? And a lot of people, I think, are absorbing that idea and going, well, I can try a garden, right? And then they discover that it's satisfying, and then it's fun to share what you've grown with other people. And then, and I want to make the point that one of the things I'm trying to emphasize in the book is do what's easy where you live. In other words, you know, if you live in a temperate climate, well, then grow potatoes, because potatoes grow really well in poor soil, and they're frost resistant, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, where I am, a tropical climate, well, then you grow what's easy, which for, you know, here is taro and breadfruit and, you know, things like that. And so I think we've gotten away from the idea that you grow what's easy and works well in where you are. And for a lot of places, that might be dairy. I mean, there's just so much variation. But yeah. The idea is do more with what you have, but do what's easy. Don't do that. Don't make it hard.
Yeah, exactly. And so it could be a wide variety of approaches, solutions. A lot of it is localized based and decentralized in that sense. And so, like, if we can give some examples too on food, I mean, not, you mentioned the garden, having your own garden. There's also local CSA programs, they call them, where there might be a farm that is being managed and run by a group of people, maybe a bunch of students even, and they're growing a large amount of food on some piece of land that they make available for like every 2 weeks. So you can go there and you pick up your basket, your box every 2 weeks, or maybe it's delivered to your home. And so that's another way to go, right? So it's coming locally, it's grown locally, it's part of maybe some cooperative or set up for community sharing. So that, you know, those are some good examples, different scenarios.
Absolutely. And learning to like what's grown locally, you know, like we've kind of gotten spoiled to some degree in that, you know, some vegetable that's completely out of season or fruit is airshipped from South America at tremendous expense. And you go, oh, well, you know, I can get grapes any time of year, you know, but is that really the a smart use of resources? And the answer is no. So, you know, it's like you eat what's in season, and that's one way of reducing your global footprint and your dependency on long supply chains. So, and it's also your health is going to improve, you know, because so much of the food that's sold by global corporations and made somewhere hundreds or thousands of miles away is processed, and it's really not that healthy. And so when you're eating real food, you're going to improve your health. And I make the point that in terms of self-reliance, our first step should be to take control of our own health and not be dependent on pharmaceutical companies and, you know, corporations packaging unhealthy food.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe we look at some examples in transportation. So self-reliance there could be, as you mentioned, maybe you've got different modes of transportation to consider. First priority would be, I mean, a lot of people have cars, you know, so maybe you try to keep a couple of spare tires, you know, due to supply chain shortages in the garage. Maybe you have an alternative means of transportation as well, like maybe a carpool sharing in the community. Oh, you have your own bicycle, and also less reliance on different types of energy input into the transportation system. So maybe not just relying on gas-powered vehicles, but having an electric vehicle, even considering having an e-bike. So an e-bike is, you know, much less cost than an electric vehicle, of course. You know, on the order of maybe $1,000 or $2,000, more or less. And so you can get one of these e-bikes and have it ready, you know, for transportation. And these are getting more widely developed, better, you know, more economical. Distance range can go up to like 70 kilometers, 40, 50 miles or so. You know, so you've got a good distance to go down to the nearest Costco and pick up some stuff, some groceries. Some of these e-bikes are actually cargo type, so you can carry a lot of stuff. They're made to carry things, either people or items and stuff. So there's lots of things that can be done there. Your thoughts, Charles?
Yeah, I think that's a great suggestion is the cargo bike, whether it's human powered or an e-bike, it's an example of a technology that already exists. There's nothing particularly fancy about it, but it's like hyper efficient compared to taking a 2 or 3,000 pound vehicle or a 5,000 pound SUV or pickup truck. And going to go buy, you know, 5 pounds of something. And the e-bike uses far less resources. And I'm not that familiar with the technology, but my assumption based on just the simplicity of the basic vehicle is it's more likely to be repairable. And so that's one of the big things about globalization and financialization is it's been planned obsolescence, right? Everything is now made to fail in a few years so that you have to buy another one. And this is, of course, very profitable for, you know, cartels and monopolies, but it's a terrible waste of resources, you know, of the planet. So an e-bike uses far less resources, right? The battery's smaller, uses far less metals and everything. And then it's more repairable, so it's more likely to last a lot longer than other technologies. And yet you can still carry a tremendous amount. And in fact, I just saw from Wired Magazine, an article describing how when there's like an emergency situation, like where the power is out in a region, maybe there's been a natural disaster, then cargo bikes can carry a tremendous consequential amount of essentials into a place where there's power has been out or, you know, there's been disruption. So that's a very good example of leveraging technology, but in a way that uses a fraction of the resources of the current economy and yet gets better results, you know, in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And you can charge your e-bike with a single panel, you know, in other words, I know if you can spend like say 25 or 30,000 for a very large photovoltaic system, you can get a system that will charge your EV vehicle. But obviously, you know, the smaller the scale, the more likely it is that we can afford it and it's going to work for us. So there's quite a range of opportunities, and just having backup batteries is a good example, and just using less. You know, buying super efficient appliances and just figuring out ways to need less, and then you consume less, and then, you know, it's self-reliance, you know, starting at the ground level is just to need less, consume less, waste less.
Yeah, I think that's a good theme that you write about frequently, right? You know, we always talk about producing and all this, but this massive amount of waste in food, waste in energy, transportation. So, you know, why not consider more higher efficiency, whether it's through innovation, a new business process optimization, perhaps, or just simply conservation techniques, you know, in different ways. Your thoughts?
Right. And I think that one topic that we really should touch on is when we talk about self-reliance, we're also talking about taking control of your assets and your capital, you know, and your skill set, you know, your human capital, your social capital, instead of giving it to some company or the government to do what they want with. I mean, the more you control and own, the less exposure you have to, like we said, globalization and financialization being either decaying or destabilizing, right? And so if you invest in yourself and in your homestead or your household self-reliance, these investments will continue to pay going forward, where you really can't make the same kind of claim about any financial asset as you can about a real world asset you own.
Yes, absolutely. That's very good. So we talked about food and transportation. There's also energy. You mentioned batteries and charging batteries. So this is another interesting area for self-reliance. I mean, you've got in a home, you may have potential for getting a generator. Now it could be gas powered or could be natural gas or you know, regular gasoline or diesel powered, but there's also a new trend now in solar generators. So this is a box that's usually made with a battery and some other additional electrical equipment in, you know, like to make it an output of different electricity. It could be DC or AC. You can also charge these initially in the home in an electrical outlet or with a solar panel. So it's quite flexible, and it essentially serves the same purpose as a solar generator. So that this again increases self-reliance. Of course, you might have solar panels for the house or wind power or wind generators. And then the community as well. I mean, they can be on the trend, right? From the transition from fossil fuels to other forms of electricity energy generation, which has an emphasis now on nuclear fission, eventually to be also including nuclear fusion, hydro, geothermal is another one. So that, there's a big energy transition happening. This is a whole big, a whole new subject that we probably can do a whole podcast on. But yeah, the whole energy crisis, especially now happening in Europe, you really need a transition and a migration strategy to get from, current state to a future state. You can't do it overnight without a plan. So that's a big problem now, in terms of the energy crisis in Europe. You just can't get rid of fossil fuels overnight. There needs to be a transition and migration plan. Your
Right.
thoughts, Charles?
Yeah, and I think that fits into our theme of self-reliance because I forgot which analyst pointed this out, but he pointed out that an electric vehicle it's only as environmentally sound as the source of electricity. So he said an EV in northern China, which relies on burning coal, he said 90% of the electricity that's going into your EV is from burning coal. So how environmentally sound is that? And the answer is it's not. So just having an EV isn't really the answer. You need to be in a place where you're close to, hydroelectric or geothermal or a nuclear plant. You have to have a source to charge your vehicle that's actually environmentally sound. But I also want to mention in fossil fuels, you can have a scooter. And again, my whole thing is, I don't think it's so important that, you say, I'm not going to use any fossil fuels. What's important is you use as little as possible. You use it efficiently. So, like a really simple motorcycle, it uses very little fuel. It takes you anywhere you want to go. And so, or even even if you're going to have a car, if you have a cheap, easy to repair, high mileage vehicle that's going to last 20 or 30 years, that's actually environmentally sound if you don't have to drive that much. If you've located, if you've arranged for remote work, I mean, so my thing is if you need 100 gallons of fuel every week just to survive, that's a lot different than if you only need 5 gallons, right? And so if you want to structure your life to use the least amount of fossil fuels, not just to save money or anything, but just because it means you're no longer as dependent on the system. And it's a lot easier to find 5 gallons of fuel than it is to find 100 gallons. So that's where I think and what we're talking about here is not like wearing a hair shirt. We're not saying, oh, you have to suffer. Actually, your life is going to improve dramatically the more you take control of your health, your energy, your food, your water, and where you live, your local culture. The more you participate and cooperate with others, your life is going to get so much better. And I mentioned in the book that the green, the blue zones, this is a book that came out a while ago, talking about where are the communities where humans live into great old age, into their 90s, and are still quite healthy. And it turns out that, of course, they're eating real food. They're participating in their community. They're often growing their own food and sharing it, sharing local wine, and so this is what's naturally healthy to human beings. And so being self-reliant, we're actually trying to go back to these very basic elements of human life, being productive, sharing, being part of the community in a productive way, and living in the locale where we live, as opposed to being totally dependent on goods and services from thousands of miles away.
Yeah. Wow, great points. And you detail a lot of these points in yesterday's blog post entitled Chart a Course to Self-Reliance. So that's on your blog of twominds.com. And you also have a link to the book, Self-Reliance in the 21st Century. And you even include a link to read the first chapter for free. There's a PDF there you can download. And I like this quote here where you mentioned self-reliance is a work in progress, not a destination.
Yeah, none of us are perfect. You know, we all can make steps and small steps add up. You know, you don't have to make any big, gigantic change. You can just make incremental improvements. And that's the philosophy I'm promoting.
Well, great. It's been an insightful discussion. Thank you very much, Charles. And again, the book is entitled Self-Reliance in the 21st Century by Charles Hugh Smith. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. I appreciate you taking the time to discuss my new book.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.